What I would like to talk to you about is what apologetics is and what apologetics is not. So if you have your handouts there, it's really just a listening guide. I realized this morning that there wasn't much room in your books for taking notes, so something I threw together really quick to kind of help you journal some of the things we talk about in here. When I first came on faculty, I came on faculty at the undergraduate school at Boyce College. I started a apologetics program for high school students. I just really loved this event for college students, and I thought we need something like this for younger students. And when I was a college pastor, I would smuggle high school students in to this event. I would hide them. You know, we would tell them which university they attended. They wouldn't lie, but we would just smuggle them in. So when I came here, we started a high school event, and I had a girl one time email me, and as we were promoting our apologetics event, and she said, "Why are Christians always apologizing for what they believe? Why, you know, you don't hear Muslims having conferences to apologize for what they believe." And, you know, of course that's a misunderstanding. Apologetics simply means to give a defense for the faith, a defense for why we believe what we believe. So we're not here to apologize. And let me just say this, Christians aren't the only ones who do apologetics. Regardless of your worldview, people are, whatever your position is, if you were another world religion or if you were a skeptic, you're articulating and defending why you believe what you believe. If you're serious about truth, how could you not do apologetics? How could you not seek to articulate why you believe what you believe? Often Christians are intimidated of having real conversations with real people. We're much more comfortable to talk in our echo chambers, to build straw man constructs and never really test out to see, is that position really what I think it is, or is it more? I think often we're afraid that we'll hear something we've never thought of before. Even for this event, I had one person come to me and have a concern about having a student who happens to be an atheist at the event. And I said, you know, why in the world would we be, why would that be an intimidating thing when you guys are going back to university campuses? So that's why I've asked Nick to come, and he really is a good friend, has become a very good friend, and I have a lot of respect for him. I shared with him at the offset of this dialogue that I have as a Christian, one of the things Nick and I share in common, we're not postmodern relativists. We both believe truth exists, that there's some tangible thing called truth, and it's not just this postmodern jelly that we're trying to nail to the wall but we'll never be able to do. There's something true. We have very big differences about what we believe that to be. But what I shared with him at the offset was that what I believe to be true has eternal ramifications. So I could talk about it objectively, but I would never want that to be... We could be dispassionate about our discourse, but I would hope that would never come off as me being disinterested. Because if what I believe is true, as of course I believe it is, then it does have eternal implications. You guys with me? Okay, so here's what apologetics isn't. Apologetics is not about showing how smart you are. It really isn't about that. There's this kind of vogue to apologetics, or Christian apologetics, I should qualify, that it's really about demonstrating how intellectual you are. If you think that you are going to win some argument on sheer intellectual power, then you're wrong. In fact, the Apostle Paul says that the gospel is foolishness to the world. But he goes on to say it's the power of God unto salvation. The Apostle Paul puts absolutely no confidence in the human intellect. He says that the wisdom of the world is actually foolishness to God, but the wisdom of God seems to be foolishness to the world. So apologetics is not about proving how smart you are. Second, apologetics is not about winning an argument. You know, I think when I first was interested in apologetics, it seemed like if you're a Christian and you really have somewhat of a disdain for this easy beliefism, fundamentalism, and, you know, this kind of... God said it, I believe it, that settles it. Just this idea that you're not supposed to think critically about things. If you're a Christian and you have somewhat of an aversion to that flavor of Christianity, then you should do apologetics. But what happens, often that results in this idea that we're just out to win an argument. And that's not what apologetics is. It's not about winning an argument. The third thing And this may seem novel to you. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. But apologetics is not primarily about evangelism. I think you get there, you get to evangelism, or proselytizing, if you want to use a word that the culture may be more familiar with. But it's not primarily about that. So let me transfer from that to what apologetics is. Apologetics is understanding the gospel. That's what apologetics is about. It's about deeply understanding the gospel. If you have your Bibles, I'm going to ask that you would turn to Colossians chapter 2. And I want to pull out just a few things about what the gospel is, what it means to understand the gospel. Okay, in Colossians chapter 2, there are three things I'll point out really quickly about the gospel. This is apologetics. We see apologetics played out in Colossians 2. Paul writes this in verse 1. "For I want you to know how great a struggle I have for you and for those at Laodicea and for all who have not seen me face to face, that their hearts may be encouraged, being knit together in love, to reach all the riches of full assurance of understanding and the knowledge of God's mystery, which is Christ." That's apologetics. It's growing in your understanding of the mystery of God revealed through Christ. Apologetics is growing in our understanding of the gospel. Verse 3, "In whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. I say this in order that no one may delude you with plausible arguments." The Apostle Paul doesn't say there are some people out there that have these extremely stupid ideas. He doesn't use bombastic language. He doesn't slam them. What does he say about their arguments? He says they're plausible. What he's saying is there are things that will sound extremely attractive. There will seem to be a logic behind it. Taken from a certain commitment, it will even seem to be a helpful explanation of the universe. He says there are plausible arguments. I don't want you to be deluded. That's apologetics. It's understanding the gospel. Verse 5, "For though I'm absent in body, yet I'm with you in spirit, rejoicing to see your good order and the firmness of your faith in Christ. Therefore, as you've received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in Him, rooted and built up in Him and established in the faith, just as you were taught, abounding in thanksgiving." Verse 8, "See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ." The gospel is first and foremost, or apologetics is first and foremost, about you understanding the depths of the gospel. It's about you abiding in Christ. It's about you dwelling in the gospel. As Martin Luther said, it's about preaching the gospel to yourselves. You should certainly preach the gospel to yourselves before you preach it to others. Apologetics is first and foremost not about you sharing the faith. It's about you dwelling in the gospel and understanding the complexity and the beauty and the grandeur of what God has accomplished for us in Christ. I love what C.S. Lewis said to the Russian cosmonaut who was an atheist, who after their successful journey into space made the statement, "We've been to outer space and we didn't find God or heaven in outer space." And C.S. Lewis made the statement in his essay, The Seeing Eye, which is a part of a larger work, God in the Dock, a collection of essays. He made the statement, "Looking for God in outer space is like Hamlet looking for Shakespeare in the attic of his house." And what he meant by that is, if Hamlet, being a creation in Shakespeare's play, was to look for the author of the play, what would be required would be that the author of the play, the playwright, write himself into the play. That if Hamlet wanted to know Shakespeare, he wouldn't find him in the attic of the house, just like the astronaut would not find God or heaven in outer space, that Hamlet would find Shakespeare only if Shakespeare wrote himself into the story. Of course, John records it this way, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. All things were created by Him, and nothing came into being, and nothing has come into being apart from Him. In Him was life, and the life was the light of man. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent by God whose name was John. He came to testify about the light. He was not the light, but he came to testify about the light." And he goes on throughout those verses and says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. Glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John goes on to write in the third chapter of his gospel, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved." So using C.S. Lewis's illustration, God has written himself into the story. The gospel is primarily, or apologetics is primarily, about understanding the gospel. I would suggest three things quickly, and I don't have time to expound on these from Colossians chapter 2 and 3, that the gospel brings clarity to our confusion, the gospel brings grace to our guilt, and the gospel brings meaning to our mortality. Understanding the beauty of the gospel is apologetics, dwelling in the gospel, seeing how the gospel gives us a foundation for purpose, meaning, for flourishing. It's found in the gospel. So apologetics is that. It's about you dwelling in Christ and seeing the beauty of Christ. That's apologetics, right? And often we so quickly move to, let me argue. Let me prove how smart I am. Let me win an argument. And that's not apologetics. Apologetics starts with your own heart. Secondly, apologetics is then understanding how the gospel relates to culture. I like how one scholar phrased it. He said, the Christian should be able to hold the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other and be able to accurately interpret them both. That's apologetics. It's dwelling in the gospel, and then it's being able to see the world through the framework of the gospel and make sense of it all. The gospel, therefore, answers the most basic questions that humans face. Where do we come from? What's wrong with the world? What's the solution? And where are we going? And so apologetics is about understanding the world we live in based on how God has written himself into our story. That's apologetics. If you're excited about apologetics, then begin preaching the gospel to yourself. Dwell in the gospel. Meditate on the gospel. You want to do apologetics? Meditate on the gospel. Dwell in it richly. Love Christ. That's apologetics. Don't rush out and get into arguments. Don't build relationships exclusively for the sake of arguing. People see through that. Have real relationships. So apologetics is understanding the gospel, and secondly, it's discerning our culture. I love what N.T. Wright said, a British Catholic scholar. Worldviews are the basic stuff of human existence. The lens through which the world is seen and the blueprint for how one should live in it. Above all, the sense of identity and place which enables human beings to be what they are. To ignore worldviews, either our own or those of the culture we are studying, would result in extraordinary shallowness. It would result in extraordinary shallowness. And I think that's so insightful, because I think a lot of what we do in the name of apologetics is extremely shallow. Because we're not dwelling in the gospel, we're not seeing how all of reality is explained through the gospel. Therefore, we build these straw man constructs because we really don't understand the very worldviews that we're trying to argue or try to dialogue with. That makes sense? Everybody hanging with me? Okay. Third, so apologetics is understanding the gospel, discerning the culture, and then finally, it's articulating your faith. Apologetics is simply explaining the gospel in terms that our current situation in life, our current setting, in terms that they can understand. If you think apologetics is about your ability to persuade or change someone's mind, you're wrong. Theologically, that is dead wrong. Theologically, we believe there are other factors at play beyond our articulating the gospel. We believe that the Spirit is required to open the eyes of one's heart, and so there's a theological framework for even how we do apologetics. But apologetics is that, in its broadest sense, about articulating your faith. I love what Francis Schaeffer said, and I quoted this earlier. Each generation of the church, in each setting, has the responsibility of communicating the gospel in understandable terms, considering the language and thought forms of that setting. That's apologetics. Let me read that one more time. Each generation of the church, in each setting, has the responsibility of communicating the gospel in understandable terms, considering the language and thought forms of that setting. So the apologetics is understanding the gospel, discerning the culture, and articulating your faith. If you're like me, you've grown ridiculously dependent upon navigational technology. I mean, I had a difficult time finding this room because a GPS cannot locate it for me. Simple tasks like finding my neighborhood grocery store is no longer simple because I don't pay attention to what roads I turn down. I listen to a female British voice because that's what we set our GPS on because that just seemed cooler. Everything seems cooler with a British accent, you know. If I don't hear her voice saying, turn left in 30 yards, I'm a little lost, right? GPS technology is really easy to plug in, turn on, but as you guys know, there's a lot more at work there. Three orbiting satellites that the government launched a long time ago, and they had nowhere in the back of their mind was the fact that you would use it to locate the nearest Starbucks on the next exit of the interstate. I mean, your caffeine fix was nowhere in their mind, but that's really become the way we find our Starbucks or anything else these days. But it works. The GPS technology works with three orbiting satellites triangulating to ascertain your location on planet Earth. That's how it works. The reason I bring all that up is to say I think for apologetics to be effective, and I think that our whole concept of what effective apologetics is entirely man-centered and therefore flawed. Are you with me? So I think we have to do away with some of those old models and old ways we measure things, and we just have to trust God and believe that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes, that anyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. But I think the best setting for apologetics is a triangulation of these three things. We word it this way for our undergraduate school. It's a triangulation of word, worldview, and witness. And when those things triangulate, I think you find a very good spot to articulate your faith from. And let me flesh those out a little bit, and then I want to give Nick ample time, and then we want to have time for Q&A. It begins by dwelling in the gospel, as I already said, word, worldview. It applies the gospel to all of life and seeing the framework for how the gospel provides a unified worldview or understanding for the world we live in. And then it results in a witness. So it begins first in my life, understanding the culture, and then having relationships, real life relationships with people that we could dialogue with. How much will your apologetics serve you if you don't know anyone who's not a Christian? And so apologetics, I think, has primarily become in many circles an in-house discussion in an echo chamber, and we listen to our own voices and we applaud ourselves for our well-planned arguments. And we know no one who holds a different world view. So apologetics is a triangulation between abiding in the gospel, understanding the culture, and then having real-life relationships where we're learning how to articulate what we believe. Chuck Colson said this: may the Christian church never be regarded as a special interest group. We're here because we love our neighbor. And it's my fear with apologetics that it becomes a special interest group, and there's no relational context for any of it to matter. So apologetics is dwelling in the gospel, understanding how the gospel applies to life, and then having real life relationships where conversations can take place. I hope, I've had a lot of conversations with believers and unbelievers alike that have not been fruitful or productive or friendly. So conversations with people who hold different views, whether they're believers or skeptics, it's not odd for those conversations to go awry. Have you had a theological conversation that ended poorly ever? Sure you have. I mean, we're all learning how to do this. I've had a number of friends that I went to youth group with who are now skeptics, whether agnostic or deist or atheist. And some of them I could have really meaningful conversations with. But I've yet to experience the depth of conversation and the ease at which we're able to converse about really big topics than what I've experienced with Nick. And I just think the world of him, the fact that he would come down from a busy, he's an engineering student, he's a part of the speed school, which they go 5 years year-round, and they graduate with a master's degree. I think he's one of the sharpest young men on their campus. I think very highly of him. He is a good friend. I enjoy spending time with Nick. I enjoy dialoguing with Nick. And I've asked Nick to come share, so I would ask that you would make him feel welcome. And Nick, come talk to us.
You can just set it on the podium. All right. So everybody can hear me, right? Am I correct? Is most of the audience from like high school or is
college?
It college. Okay, cool. That's what it looked like, college, but we mentioned maybe high school. All right. So it's kind of like Dan said. Dan had asked me originally to come up with, I guess, like five things I wish Christians knew. I thought that was condescending. I'm not really good at advice, and I'm not really good at lists, typically. So I was a little bit hesitant. The way I approach this is the way I normally approach advice. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I sort of try to put myself in your position. So this is atheist and apologetic. So I try to put myself in the position of a Christian apologist and tried to put the things that I've learned from talking with someone with a different perspective to work for that. So I've come up with a list. It's actually, interestingly enough, Dan and I didn't compare notes as we were like coming up with this. So Dan talked a lot about how apologetics wasn't arguing. The very number one thing on my list is to argue. I think it's a very important thing. And so the difference there, I think, comes from the two different ideas of what arguing is. I'm pretty confident that if Dan and I videotaped many of our conversations, played it back for an audience, most of them would say that we actually aren't arguing. I've never called Dan a moron. He's never called me an idiot. And usually it's understood that like that's an important part of arguing. It's the sort of venom. You have to really want to win at all costs almost to argue. But even though I'm an engineer, I have a great respect for philosophy, and that's sort of the approach that I go. That's sort of the way that I approach arguments. So an argument has a lot to bring to the table in that whenever you're arguing with someone, you are forced to articulate your own viewpoint, and you're putting it up for scrutiny. So. Like Dan said, it's really difficult to argue in an echo chamber. It's really difficult to argue with someone who holds the exact same positions as you. That's why it's very important, for instance, to me, to go to campus church for a year and to argue with, you know, 30, 40, 50 people who totally disagree with almost everything I believe. And I think that's why it's also really refreshing for me to be able to do that. Because it's, I don't know, I think Christians get a really bad sort of reputation for liking those echo chambers and those, you know, those fake circumstances where you're not challenged. And if Dan is willing to, I guess, break that stereotype, I'm right behind it. So the number one, I guess, thing I, not that I wish Christians knew, but the number one piece of advice I could give to you if you want to engage in apologetics with atheists is to argue, to not be afraid to argue. There's a lot that arguing brings to the table, and it might not necessarily be different from what you would imagine. The other thing is, so number two is to be honest. So this doesn't necessarily mean that I'm afraid that everyone in this room would lie to an atheist if you were arguing with an atheist. But I think there is a great danger of not being frank and not being open. Once you begin to engage in an argument, one of the problems with an argument, and everyone recognizes this, is the idea that there will be a winner and there will be a loser at the end of the argument, and nobody wants to lose. So you have to be careful to be frank and open about, for instance, ideas you've never thought about before. There's nothing wrong with working out an idea in front of someone who be very critical of it for the very first time. It's a frightening thing, but it's really rewarding whenever you come up with some interesting things. But it's a terrible idea to do this and pretend that you know what you're talking about. And this is something that will inevitably happen. I don't know what everyone in this room is studying, but I can guarantee you that if you intend to engage with atheists, you will most likely be studying. You will most likely have a background different from the skeptic or the atheist. So if you're not honest about what you know and what you don't know, what you're confident in and what you're not confident in, you or the other party will get in trouble. So the next piece of advice I have is to have fun. And so this is one that sometimes it's easier, sometimes it's harder to keep it in mind. But this sort of conversation can be enormously rewarding, whether you're winning or losing. Being proved wrong in the long run, if you take the long view, can be one of the most rewarding experiences of your entire life. What you get out of it is a better understanding of something that you would not have had if you hadn't engaged in this argument, this dialogue. We intentionally called our conversation a dialogue, and I think it was a good idea. I'm glad it's not the ChristianArgument.com. So have fun. And obviously, I don't think I need to tell anybody that if you discuss something with a skeptic and you prove them wrong about something, it's going to be fun. You know, you're going to, in the back of your head, if not overtly, you're going to be smiling. And there's nothing wrong with that. But also, be sure to have fun, you know, if you're on the other side too. It's not necessarily terrible. So along similar lines, my next piece of advice is to keep everyone on the same level. This is very important. Dan likes to pull out quotes every time he gives discussions. So my quote is, and I don't know if it's an actual quote of Einstein's, but it's often said that Einstein thought that you didn't really understand something if you couldn't explain it to your grandmother. You could go to the website. I'm an electrical engineer, and a transistor has never been mentioned in our, like, 10,000 words of dialogue or more. So what I am mostly doing in this is talking about something that I don't have a firm background in. And that's often what Dan does, too. It's inevitable whenever you're talking about, you know, the most important things with life, the most important basis for life. So don't be afraid to, I guess, to almost teach. Don't be afraid to, if you have a philosophy background, you know, give someone a really quick lesson in philosophy. But also don't be afraid to learn. This is sometimes the most difficult part. You have to be careful not to overestimate your understanding of something you don't understand. And you also have to be a little bit brave whenever you're the one learning, which, I don't know. Sometimes, once you get used to it, it's not so bad.
You're still teaching the meme theory.
Meme theory? Yeah, we haven't gotten around to that. But meme theory is very fascinating. We can talk about that afterwards. So as an example, a really interesting thing, I don't think this takes away from Dan's little discussion, but I don't know how many of you are familiar with relativity, but Dan got GPS a little bit wrong. You actually need 4 satellites. Relativity theory means, because there's not a fixed reference in time, you have to triangulate things in the 3 positional dimensions and time. So you need a 4th satellite.
Yeah.
So it's like you wouldn't be triangulating it; you'd be like squaring it. But anyway.
It just doesn't sound like it.
No, it doesn't. And you had a list of 3 things, so it didn't really work. But I mean, that's just, I don't know, it's not always terrible to learn something new. Last but not least is have an open mind. You really, something that's really interesting that I've learned from this dialogue and others is that usefully criticize something, to usefully criticize an idea, you have to try it on. You have to have an open enough mind. I have to have an open enough mind, having not been a Christian for 3 years, whenever I'm discussing things with Dan, to pretend to be a Christian for a moment to understand what he's saying. And it's sometimes a very difficult thing, but it's very important if you want to be discussing things with skeptics and atheists. You have to be able to do the same thing. And that's one of the things I value about my time with Dan, is that again, this is breaking down the stereotype. Christians are closed-minded, they don't leave the Bible Belt. But I mean, it's totally false, obviously. Hopefully you know this. Surely you do. But it's not an easy thing to do. So I appreciate that whenever Dan does it, and whenever he is patient with me, whenever it's difficult for me to do it. But anyway, having an open mind is an extremely important part of arguing. So those are the 5 things that I came up with. I don't know.
Well, I'm going to make a few comments before we transition to Q&A, but I'd like to follow up on a couple of things. Early in our conversation, you had, before we started the blog,
yeah,
you had said something to me like, you didn't want me to water down.
Oh, yeah.
Or to soft pedal.
Yeah, so I guess there are, like, kind of 2 reasons that I can think of that someone would want to have a serious conversation with someone with a different belief. You know, you would either be interested in like testing your beliefs in fire, you'd be interested in like, you know, sharpening your skills, or you would be interested in convincing them that they were wrong, you know. So you're either trying to make your ideas better or make their ideas better. And this is a totally worthless endeavor if you're holding back. So I don't know. It's really important to me. It's something that's really valuable to me that Dan doesn't water things down for me, that whenever Dan is like going onto this like public campus with a bunch of skeptics, he doesn't water down his views to trick us into coming into Campus Church and then surprise us with the gospel or something. I don't think that would work. And I think it's obvious why that wouldn't work. So I don't know.
Tell them about the Secular Student Society, and even if you want to mention that work co-sponsoring.
Yeah. So we started this dialogue almost a year ago during the summer. So we started at the beginning of the summer. In a way, something that's kind of been born out of that is the Society of Secular Students. It's a new enterprise on U of L's campus. We're a recognized student organization, and we're co-sponsoring an event with the campus church. I believe it's not Southern Baptist, right? With the campus church, Good Without God. It's a debate about whether the idea of God or religion is necessary to be good, being involved with something like the campus church where we're like openly discussing, arguing, dialoguing. It's really helped me as far as starting an enterprise like the Society of Secular Students, which is about that general idea, but you know, more of a secular slant, obviously. So.
You want to say anything about Nick had invited in one of our professors here, Timothy Paul Jones, who's just a great guy. And Nick had invited Timothy in to speak at an event on the historicity.
Yeah, so our first event, that was interesting. We have Society of Secular Students is a group of about like 40 atheists, basically. And so we were trying to figure out what our first event would be. And we decided that our first event would be on the historicity of Jesus. And the only speaker we could get is the quite conservative Dr. Timothy Paul Jones from Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I don't know, that's one of my favorite things about this this place is that they're all really good sports. So Dr. Timothy Paul Jones came in, talked to about 40 atheists about the historicity of Jesus, did so, you know, with great skill. Everyone in the group was impressed. No one had a bad thing to say about his intellect or his ability to argue. We came to different conclusions, but it was a valuable conversation to have, I thought.
We feel like that illustrates kind of what we're telling them to do, to be able to articulate what they believe in a winsome, fast manner, even if it's in a setting where people predominantly disagree.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I feel like if you can't do that, if you're not willing to do that, then you can't be confident in what you believe. I don't know.
All right, we're going to have Q&A in just a second. So let's thank Nick.
I will.
We're recording this. That's why we're having to... We could probably just talk really loud and you could hear us very well. I want to kind of wrap up this part of the conversation by telling you about a few events that we've done on campus that big picture event, I think that there are some principles you could take home and apply on a one-on-one level. That makes sense. This may not be what you envisioned when you signed up for this elective. I did not want it to be, because I don't want to nurture what I think is a bad attitude of let's all huddle together and talk about how smart and convincing we are without ever having some relational context. So before I asked Nick to share, I wanted him here just to keep me honest, because I don't want to say in front of you something that I wouldn't feel comfortable saying in front of him who sees me on a regular basis. Here are a few events we've done. We did one event called Christianity True or False, which is where I think he first met Timothy Paul Jones. And what we did to promote that event, we went down to campus. There's a section of campus where the street preachers will street preach. It's called the
public free speech corner? People, okay, it's in the middle of their quad, I guess you would call it. Before, not try. Okay, sorry, you're an engineer. I'm trying to make sure I get the numbers right. So there's this little corner where people street preach. And to give you an example of one couple, how they street preach, it's an older gentleman who wears a suit and tie. His wife has a skirt that goes down to her ankles, and she will get up first, and he'll sit down. You may have seen them before. He literally has a soapbox, not figurative. And she will start by looking at the girls walking by and begin calling them whores. So she'll say, "Whore! You're a whore!" And that solicits a lot of attention, which I think is intentional, a lot of attention. And so people will start to gather up and because they're offended, and then he'll get on his soapbox and preach. And there's some other street preachers. You could be your own judge. I'm not saying that all street preaching is wrong. I've just not really seen many cases where I felt excited about the manner in which it was done. But we went to that corner and we put up a big banner that had a cross. You know the no smoking sign with the... It had a cross marked out. And it said, "Christianity, true or false." And we just had a video camera and students would come by and we would say, "Tell us whether or not Christianity is true or false." And so we just let them talk and share. And then we would interact with them. But we let them, we want to hear from you. And I think that's an example of apologetics, is getting to know people. It's not just testing out just to hone our skills, because we believe there's an eternal implication of what we're doing, but that is part of it. So we did that to promote the event. We set up a website where we put all the videos. We took pictures. People could take colored pieces of paper and write true or false and then hold that up while they would talk about whether or not Christianity was true or false. We had more people say to us, I thought it was cool that you wanted to hear from us. And we saw the cross X'd out where normally the street preachers stand, and we thought, oh, this has to be good. But we were there to hear from them. Do we have an agenda? Of course we do. And I think Nick would share this. I hope I've been clear that I have an agenda. But to be true, you know, if Nick, and he does, believes his way of viewing the world is true, as a lover of truth and a pursuer of truth, he would want to convince someone who he believed was wrong about a superior way of seeing truth. So we have an agenda, but we just go about in a way that there's dialogue there. When we have our events, we always follow it, usually by a longer period of Q&A than there was actual presentation. So we've had Dr. Moeller, we've had Dr. Morse come down to campus. We did an event called Is God Green? So we have an event this month that's Do Muslims and Christians Worship the Same God? So that's just an example of some of the things we're trying to do. What I want to say to you is, if you're serious about apologetics, dwell in the gospel, understand how the gospel applies to all of life, and then have real life relationships. If you come here this morning for like the best practices tips, the one nugget, the one argument that will convince anyone, I just can't give it to you. And so if you're disappointed, I apologize. But this is kind of what real life atheism and apologetics looks like. On our campus at the University of Louisville, there's a thinking man statue. The naked guy with his furrowed brow. It's on your handout. I fully did not intend to have pornographic handouts, but there is a statue of a naked man. I apologize if you're offended. But that statue is not originally known as the thinker. The artist who made that made it as a part of a larger work. It was originally called the poet. It was supposed to depict Dante, and Dante as the great poet who is sitting contemplating the masses who were being judged by a holy God. And so when I drive on our campus and see what's become an icon of philosophy, I think about a man who's deeply touched by the reality of a holy God who will judge a sinful people, yet offers forgiveness and salvation. I hope you'll do the same. I hope today has been encouragement.